From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The arrest of Chinese-American human rights activist Harry Wu is causing the further deterioration of relations between the U.S. and China. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear an excerpt of a 1994 interview with Wu. He spent 19 years in Chinese prison labor camps. After emigrating to the U.S., he's returned to China to secretly document abuses. Now he's accused of espionage. We'll also hear from China expert Orville Schell. Nearly 35 years ago, FCC Commissioner Newton Minow called TV a vast wasteland. Now he says children's programming leaves children abandoned in the wasteland. We'll talk about TV then and now. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Neil Young's new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution condemning the Bosnian Serb offensive against the safe haven of Srebrenica. The resolution demands that the Bosnian Serbs immediately withdraw from the UN-designated safe area. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The resolution requests Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali to use all the resources available to him to restore Srebrenica's status as a safe area. French President Jacques Chirac has volunteered the French Rapid Reaction Force to liberate Srebrenica. However, as in the past, troop contributors like France, while publicly calling for robust action, have in private urged the Secretary General not to attack the Bosnian Serbs. The fear is they will retaliate against UN peacekeepers throughout Bosnia. When asked how he planned to secure the withdrawal of Bosnian Serb forces from Srebrenica, Boutros-Ghali indicated that he would turn to negotiation. Few observers expect the Bosnian Serbs to withdraw. The result is that the latest council resolution will likely join a long list of others that have been ignored by the Bosnian Serbs. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
President Clinton says there are steps that schools can take to open the door to religious expression without being coercive. He's ordered the Education and Justice Departments to hand out a guide to schools to let them know what they can do. Mr. Clinton says the government must work hard not to dictate or demand religious beliefs, but he says when the First Amendment is used as a block to practice one's religion, it's being misused. The president says religious clubs should be able to use school buildings, and students should be able to pray or read religious books during free time, like in study hall. A group of rightist Israeli rabbis issued a religious ruling today. They say Israeli soldiers are forbidden to evacuate Israeli military bases on the West Bank. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The rabbis are headed by a former chief rabbi of Israel, Avraham Shapira. The ruling means that hundreds, if not thousands, of Orthodox soldiers will have to refuse an order from their commanders to leave their bases. The ruling comes as Israel and the PLO are on the verge of signing an agreement for an Israeli army withdrawal from West Bank towns and Palestinian elections. Israeli politicians and senior army officers were furious about the ruling, saying it could lead to a civil war in Israel. President Azer Weitzman called on the rabbis to rescind the ruling, and Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said it is unthinkable. In Israel, the army has always been seen as a unifying symbol for the whole country. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
First Chicago Corporation and NBD Bancorp say they'll merge in a stock deal worth $6.25 billion. The combined firm will be called First Chicago NBD Corporation and will have $120 billion in assets. On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 42 points at 4722. This is NPR. Some Republican lawmakers say President Clinton's move to establish full diplomatic ties with Vietnam is a slap in the face for MIA families. They held a hearing today that most Democrats boycotted. New Jersey Congressman Chris Smith says Vietnamese authorities have only created an illusion of cooperation in providing a full accounting of missing Americans from the war. Other Republicans accuse Vietnam of withholding the remains of up to 400 dead servicemen. Many opponents of normalizing ties say the remains of servicemen will never be recovered now. The Miss America organization says it'll let viewers of this year's pageant decide whether the controversial swimsuit competition will be part of the show. From New York, NPR's Melissa Block reports.
At a news conference in New York, the head of the Miss America organization announced the pageant will conduct what will amount to an instant poll. Television viewers of the September competition will be encouraged to call a 1-900 number during the show to vote on whether contestants will appear in their swimsuits. It's unclear how much the calls will cost, and if the majority votes no, it's unclear what kind of competition would replace it. The swimsuit competition will remain an integral part of the qualifying contests that take place before the pageant is televised and that help determine the finalists. The Miss America pageant, which began in 1921, has been evolving slowly. Last year was the first year that contestants did not wear high heels during the swimsuit competition. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
The U.S. Embassy in Beijing says American human rights activist Harry Wu has been given a list of Chinese lawyers. He's being held by China on charges of spying. A conviction could bring the death penalty. It's not clear if Wu will be allowed to select his own attorney. The U.S. Consul General in Beijing has visited Wu and given him books, newspapers, and writing paper. He's not been allowed to discuss the case with Wu. The activist has angered China repeatedly over secret visits to the country to document human rights abuse. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week, Chinese-American human rights activist Harry Wu was arrested in China and charged with espionage. Wu spent 19 years, from 1960 to 79, in Chinese prison labor camps for such crimes as being an intellectual and a bourgeois. He's lived in the U.S. since 1985 and became a citizen last year. The determination he once used to keep himself alive in prison, he has since used to try to expose human rights violations within Chinese prisons. At great risk, he's returned to China several times to document prison abuses. On one of his trips, he snuck into prison labor camps and used a hidden camera to film a report for the news program 60 Minutes. Wu has often testified on Capitol Hill about Chinese human rights abuses. Both houses of Congress have passed resolutions condemning China for his imprisonment. In a few minutes, we'll talk with China expert Orville Schell about how this is affecting Chinese-American relations, which were already at perhaps the lowest point since normalization in 1979. First, we're going to hear an interview I recorded with Harry Wu in January of 1994, after the publication of his memoir, Bitter Wind. He told me that in order to survive in prison, he turned himself into a beast.
If you're thinking you are human beings, then you are thinking about freedom, family, future, sex, right and wrong, and those things only cause suffering. And a hungry beast only thinking about grabbing food from anywhere, it's easy to survive.
One of the ways you found to get a little bit of extra food was to look for rat holes, because where there was a rat hole, the rat might have stashed some grain, some corn. What was the best stash you ever found in a rat hole?
I still remember my very lucky times. I found a rat horse. The rat is a very good collector. They collect same size, the soybean, they collect the rice, collect the corn, and in their hole, even you pour the water, you cannot damage the storage. If one day one of the prisoners can find a rat horse, then he become like a millionaire, you know. It's really good. And if we can cut the rats, and also we eat it.
And the rats too? So you ate rats?
I ate it. I ate a lot. And also the frogs, snakes, any kind of life.
When you would find food, would you try to share it with other people?
No, never.
Or was it's too important to survive?
No, never. Yeah. Never. Never share with the other people. And always try to grab the people from other people. I did it many times. I beat in them and robbed their food. If I'm strong, I did.
A couple of years ago, in 1991, you decided to go back to China to try to document the prison camp system there. And you took a hidden camera with you. You did this for 60 minutes, so they helped, I guess, equip you with what you needed to take pictures and to take video. Why did you take the risk to go back to China and do that?
First of all, the pieces of land in the Asia we call China, that is my motherland. My parents, my brother, they're still over there. And many, many of my inmates, my friends, they're over there. I cannot stop thinking about them. The nightmares always come back to me. I'm lucky. I survive. I want to enjoy my life in a peaceful land. I'm a very normal person. I want to be loved. I want to love. But I cannot turn back on these people. These nameless, voiceless, faceless people. Forget means betray. I cannot do that.
Harry Wu recorded last year. Harry Wu is now imprisoned in China on charges of espionage. My guest Orville Schell is the author of several books about contemporary China, including Discos and Democracy, To Get Rich is Glorious, and his latest, Mandate of Heaven. Schell is a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum at Columbia University and serves as vice chair of Human Rights Watch Asia. Orville Schell knows Harry Wu. Earlier today, I asked Schell if he comprehended why Wu risked his life to document human rights violations in Chinese prisons.
Well, it's been a question that I've asked myself many times and indeed asked him as well, because he is such a singular person. Not only that he's willing to take risks, but that he has such a dogged determination, this obligation he feels to bear witness to the dark side of the Chinese Revolution, which he experienced for 19 years. And this is, I think, very unique in China, where, you know, particularly of late, people's tendency, if possible, is to forget and to sort of be very ahistorical, to try to begin again as if the edifice of society and reform and the economic miracle didn't really need to sit on any historical foundation, or if the country, the society as a whole, didn't really need to come to terms with the magnitude of the brutality and the self-inflicted brutality that so many people suffered over the past 35, 40 years.
What specific conditions has Harry Wu been trying to expose in Chinese prisons?
Well, he, as you know, spent 19 years in a series of reform through labor camps, and he was put into them for reasons which are still obscure to him. I mean, it really was a Chinese version of Kafka's trial, that try as you may, you can't ascertain why you're there. And when he asked, he was simply be told, you know why you're there. You know, the perfect way to summon up all sorts of guilt in someone without ever actually telling them what their crime is. And I think that this experience was so brutal that during the worst of it in the early 60s, when a mass famine swept China and 20 to 30 million people died and conditions in the prisons were just abominable, and one of his friends died in his arms and he saw many other people die in their sleep beside him, he simply decided that if he ever got out, he would bear witness, that this would be his, you know, almost sacred obligation.
Now, I know he did a report for the BBC on how the body organs of executed prisoners were being used for medical transplants to wealthy Chinese people. And this was also the subject of a report by Human Rights Watch Asia, which was issued last summer. What are the specific ethical and human rights violations that are being charged here?
Well, most Chinese find it unacceptable upon death to surrender organs for transplantation. This is just a cultural bias. So this means that there's a real deficit of things such as kidneys, corneas, livers, pancreases, organs of that nature. Now, from a very practical point of view, many Chinese see nothing wrong with extracting these organs from prisoners who are executed, thinking that in a certain kind of a realistic way, this helps them pay their debt to society. And here we run into a whole series of cultural biases that, you know, prisoners don't have rights, neither do dead people in China. It's very different from the kind of cast we put on these sorts of things here in the West. So this has meant that as the medical science made transplantation more and more popular and is a rather common route of curing people with terminally diseased organs, that the temptation to take them out of prisoners, indeed sometimes to take them from prisoners before they were fully dead, to schedule executions to coincide with actual operations and to have the public security bureaus and hospitals link up, was very great. And there's numerous instances of documentation which really show, I think, beyond a reasonable shadow of doubt that this is a very widespread phenomena. And some people think, you know, upwards to 90% of all transplanted organs come from executed prisoners.
Now, Harry Wu's BBC report has been challenged on this basis. That footage that he showed, that he said was footage of a transplant of an executed prisoner's kidney, was actually footage of a routine heart operation. What do you know about that?
Well, I think it was a bit of at least quasi-sloppy journalism on the part of the BBC to show instance of chest surgery when they were talking about the transplantation of other organs. But I think what happened was they were at a certain hospital where Harry Wu was inquiring about getting a kidney, and they allowed them to see this operation. And so they, I think, somewhat foolishly put it on the screen, and it's very obvious what it is. It isn't a kidney operation. But having said that, one doesn't want to defend it. But I think it doesn't in any way cancel the rest of the BBC's report, and indeed many other reports that have also in great detail documented this practice as being commonplace.
Both houses of Congress passed resolutions condemning China for Harry Wu's arrest and urging President Clinton to use every diplomatic means to win Wu's release. Do you think that Harry Wu is, that his arrest is kind of playing into different political agendas in Congress?
Well, I mean, I think Congress, in a certain sense, is rightfully incensed. But in another sense, I mean, it's an all-win situation for them. They don't really have to do much except pass resolutions. So they don't have to work out the praxis of how you get Harry Wu out and how you work out a really workable foreign policy. But I think, you know, it's about time for the president to do what President Bush did. I didn't really agree with everything he said, but he went to Yale and he gave a real China policy speech. And I think this is long overdue. I think it would clear the air. And I think if we were to arch our backs a little bit at the same time that we try to find common ground with China on certain other grounds, it would be a very sort of salutary thing and might help choke up this terrible knot that we both have swallowed, both of our countries.
Let's look at why this is such a low point in Chinese-American relations. President Clinton recently allowed the president of Taiwan to come to the United States. Why was that so upsetting to China?
Well, you know, I think presently in China, the government, the party, the whole edifice of its political structure feels tremendously weak. You know, Deng Xiaoping is basically non compos mentis. There's going to be a very...
He's what, almost 90?
He's going to be 91 next month. And everybody knows that there's liable to be trouble after that. So I think they're feeling very vulnerable at home. And whenever the Chinese politicians and the party feels weak at home, they tend to project and they tend to try to export issues so that people will pay attention to relations, what's going on abroad or between them and Taiwan. And so Taiwan is a perfect issue for them to sort of rant, rave, and rail about when they feel they've got to express some toughness. They've got to show some spine. And I think that's pretty much what we see. But we also have to be mindful of the fact that this is a very sensitive issue. You know, the integrity of the motherland, it's what makes Tibet such a bedeviling issue and makes autonomy sort of so unthinkable. But Taiwan, too, they imagine as theirs. So any insinuation that it's not gives them ample opportunity to sort of puff up and act out on an international on the international scene.
What are some of the other reasons that relations between the U.S. and China have deteriorated?
Well, Terry, you know, I think that one of the things we're seeing is a kind of an inchoate sense that many people feel, many Americans feel, and Europeans, that there's something wrong in China. They know about the economic miracle, and it really is very impressive, and you know, kudos should be given to China in a certain way, but there is this kind of sense that there's something mutant about what's happening. It's too fast, it's too unplanned, it's too rapacious, it's unfair, it's exploitative, all of these things. And so when something like Harry Wu comes along and a big incident develops, I think it has a way of crystallizing all this sort of inchoate bad feeling and allows people to use it as a kind of an outlet. It's a thing, something to gang up on, and I think we see this in Congress, a tremendous frustration amongst, you know, liberals and conservatives alike that China has not been held to account. Now you have to ask yourself, should we hold it to account? That's another question. Does the United States have the right to pass judgment on other countries and other systems and to interfere? Traditionally, we've always done that. We view it as a kind of our manifest destiny, whether it's missionaries or the World War II or the Cold War, Korea, Vietnam. I mean, we do project ourselves. But the Chinese see this as a real insult, and they don't like it.
My guest is Orville Schell. His latest book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with China expert Orville Schell. Our relations with China are unusual in the sense that, you know, the Cold War is over, yet China is still a communist country, but it's a communist country with this economic miracle, and we have a lot of business investments there and want to have even more. How much of the Cold War do you think is still in our relationship with China, still affecting our relationship with China?
Well, I think for people like Jesse Helms, you know, old anti-communists, it's very much present. And I think we have to kind of redefine it. We can't sort of mine these old Cold War sentiments. On the other hand, we can't just sort of surrender. And I think particularly to the mythology that, you know, open markets and business are going to create democracy. That's very fallacious. They may help and in the long run may have a very profound effect. In the short run, it may need more to open China up. And it's, I think that particular sort of myth is one that really does deserve to be analyzed very closely. But it serves, you see, as a surrogate for any other kinds of action. People who feel, oh yes, we should do something, but on the other hand, we don't want to disturb business. Well, we'll just say that open markets equal open societies. But it's an incomplete analysis of what's going on, because I think it's possible, and we do see it, that to get what some have referred to as, you know, gulag capitalism or Leninist capitalism, where you have a political apparatus of the old Leninist mold riding herd on a Wild West, you know, market economy that's booming in ways that what we hardly could have imagined 5-6 years ago.
Well, as relations between the U.S. and China continue to deteriorate, China is planning to host the UN International Women's Conference in September. How is that progressing?
Well, it's progressing. You know, they've tried to sort of export it out of Beijing to get it away from the city because they're very fearful of what might happen when you get 35,000 outsiders running around a society which is politically closed. One of the things that I fear is that if the Harry Wu situation is not resolved, I could well imagine that you'd have people lined up in Tiananmen Square to, you know, drop banners saying "Free Harry Wu," which would be a terrible humiliation for China and would force them to act in ways which would just compound the problem and I think would give the Women's Conference a real black eye. So, I mean, this is no joke what's happened, and they've dug the hole a little deeper after they detained him and then accused him of espionage. It makes it a little harder to get out of. But I think until we find some solution to this problem, the women's conference is sort of the next stop on the train for trouble.
It's conceivable that Harry Wu could spend the rest of his life in a Chinese prison. Do you find yourself thinking what it would be like for him to spend the rest of his life back in a Chinese prison camp after having already survived 19 years there?
Well, you know, almost any other human being on Earth, I would be very worried about. Harry Wu is really tough. He has steeled himself to this. And the great paradox of his arrest is that he is carrying out his own work, the solitary individual, in a way which is infinitely more effective by doing nothing in this kind of Zen, Taoist, Wu Wei, non-action manner, by sitting wherever he is in China, than he ever was able to do by being running around full speed outside of China. So for his purposes, and I think he knows this, to be there is to be successful. And I think the Chinese will realize this, too, and will want to put an end to it.
Did you ever find yourself saying to him, Harry, don't go. You're going to get arrested. I mean, why?
I bring this
on yourself.
I've said this to him every time, and there is an element about him which, I mean, there is a bit of zealotry in Harry Wu. There are very few people who would take his risks, but he, you know, has consecrated himself to this task. And it is a sacred task, and there is nothing on earth which is going to make him relent.
There's a second political prisoner who has been in the news. This is Chen Ziming, who was a leader of the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989. He spent 5 years in prison. He was released in May of 1994 for medical treatment. Then on the sixth anniversary of the crackdown, he signed a pro-democracy petition, conducted a day-long fast, and then ended up back in prison. Do you know him?
I've not met him. Of course, I know of his case. But I think, you know, what it's very tempting to imagine when you think of Chen Ziming or Harry Wu or Wei Jingsheng, who was in prison for 15 years, got out, and then a year ago disappeared for another year and is still gone. It's very easy to imagine that the Chinese government is this sort of monolithic organization that's just taking these people away. But I think what's closer to the truth is that there's enormous debate within the hierarchy and enormous disagreement. Because after all, the people, for instance, in the foreign ministry who have to deal with the outside world, know that when they take someone off like this and lock them up, it has profound international repercussions, and they have to deal with those. On the other hand, there's people who are in China, maybe they haven't been abroad much, and they don't really care what the United States or any other country does. They just say, lock these bums up. You know, they're counter-revolutionaries. But I think that if we could eavesdrop on the Central Committee, we would find that not only was there great disagreement, but certain arms of the government just act and leave other arms to kind of deal with it. And that there's probably an awful lot of bad blood over these cases.
Do you know anything about the conditions that Harry Wu is being held under now and what the prison is like where he's being held?
Well, what we know from the consular visit that finally did take place, the U.S. consul, is that he is not being tortured, he's not being abused, and I suspect he's being treated very well. He may be, you know, they have many prisons, as we have here, which are rather luxurious by standards of ordinary prisoners. And I think he will receive quite careful, meticulous, if not royal treatment. And I don't worry that he will be physically abused, and I think it is almost unthinkable that he would be executed. One never knows, but this is my hunch. Harry Wu is too high visibility. He's too well connected in Congress and with the media and around the world for the Chinese to give him any more reasons than they already have to sound his horn when he gets out.
Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, as ever, Terry, it's a great pleasure.
Orville Schell's latest book about China is called Mandate of Heaven. He's a senior fellow at the Freedom Forum at Columbia University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. and by borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1961, FCC Commissioner Newton Minow called TV a vast wasteland. The expression stuck. In the new book Abandoned in the Wasteland, Minow offers his critique of children's television and his suggestions for regulating it. We'll talk about TV then and now. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Neil Young's new CD, Mirror Ball. We're listening to it now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. French President Jacques Chirac says the failure by the international community to recapture a key Muslim enclave puts the UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia in doubt. France is continuing its calls for military action against the Serbs. Lynn Terry reports.
President Jacques Chirac said the United Nations cannot abandon Srebrenica to the Bosnian Serbs. He said if the UN does not recapture the eastern enclave and protect the other so-called safe areas, the entire peacekeeping mission in Bosnia would be put in doubt. Chirac indicated France might have to consider a pullout, though he clearly does not relish this option. Chirac also attacked Bosnian government forces, saying they had failed to protect Srebrenica. He said he was discussing with other countries with troops in Bosnia what to do to protect enclaves under Serb attack. But Chirac's demand for action against the Bosnian Serbs was not echoed by Britain. French commentators criticized Chirac for talking tough but not taking concrete action on the ground. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
President Clinton says he's taken steps to help public schools open the door to students' religious expression without being coercive. He's ordered the Education Department and the Justice Department to give schools a guide to let them know what they can legally do to support religious freedom. He told a group of students at a Virginia high school that religious clubs should be able to meet and students should be able to pray individually.
I know that most schools do a very good job of protecting students' religious rights, but some students in America have been prohibited from reading the Bible silently in study hall. Some student religious groups haven't been allowed to publicize their meetings in the same way that non-religious groups can. Some students have been prevented even from saying grace before lunch. That is rare, but it has happened, and it is wrong. Wherever and whenever the religious rights of children are threatened or suppressed, we must move quickly to correct it.
Some Republicans want a constitutional amendment allowing organized school prayer. President Clinton says he opposes that. He says students should be able to practice their beliefs, but the Constitution doesn't give them the right to force people to listen to prayers or participate in them. The New Jersey Supreme Court has approved the state's request to take over the troubled schools of Newark. The state judges rescinded a lower court stay, preventing the state from taking control. Newark schools make up the state's largest school district. The plan calls for dismissal of top Newark school officials, including the 9-member school board. The state of New Jersey says failing academic performance, high dropout rates, and ineffective use of funding prompted this action. On Wall Street, stock prices rose sharply today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 46.5 points to end the day at 4,727. Advances led declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. The Russian lower house of parliament failed in an effort to impeach President Boris Yeltsin. The motion was 58 votes short. Approval would have permitted the lawmakers to consider impeachment hearings. Russian nationalist leader Vladimir Shirinovsky says lawmakers don't want Yeltsin to get sicker because of their parliamentary actions. Yeltsin is hospitalized with a heart ailment. Shirinovsky says impeachment proceedings now would be indecent. A Yeltsin spokesman says the president is in good condition and he's doing business from his hospital bed. A new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association says women who take hormones to reduce the symptoms of menopause are not putting themselves at greater risk of breast cancer. The report comes 1 month after another report linked the hormones to breast cancer. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
Researchers from the University of Washington compared about 500 women with breast cancer to 500 cancer-free women. An equal proportion of both groups had used hormone replacement therapy, estrogen or estrogen plus progestin. That suggests that the hormones aren't responsible for the cancer. But last month, Harvard researchers studying more than 100,000 women concluded that hormone use increases the risk of breast cancer by 30% to 40%. While the breast cancer relationship is unclear, postmenopausal hormone use clearly does reduce heart disease and osteoporosis. The National Institutes of Health has just begun a trial that ought to clarify just what postmenopausal hormones mean for overall health. The results are expected early next century. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
A Senate panel is considering a plan that would require broadcast and cable TV providers to air violent programming when children are not likely to be watching. The Federal Communications Commission would have the power to determine what hours of the day such programming could be banned. It is not clear at this time what programs would qualify as violent. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Newton Minow, is the man who first described TV as a vast wasteland. He used those words in a speech to the National Association of Broadcasters in 1961, shortly after President Kennedy appointed him commissioner of the FCC. During Minow's tenure, the U.S. launched the first communications satellite, Telstar, and TV manufacturers were required to include UHF channels on all sets. Minow later served as chair of PBS and is now head of the Carnegie Corporation and a professor of communications law and policy at Northwestern University. In the new book, Abandoned in the Wasteland, Minow and co-author Craig LeMay discuss a subject a Senate panel wrestled with today: should children's programming be regulated, and if so, how? Earlier this week, President Clinton endorsed the idea of a V-chip, an electronic chip that would allow parents to screen out programs coded as violent. Minow is an advocate of the V-chip.
I think it gives parents control. That's where the control should be. It should not be strictly in the hands of the broadcaster. It should not be strictly in the hands of the child. I think a parent needs to have one hand on the control stick, particularly where small children are involved, and the V-chip accommodates that. It transfers control to the parent.
Then you've got the problem of devising the coding system. Who do you think should come up with the code and decide what,
rate
the programs?
Should not be the government. The coding should be done, I think, in multiple ways. I think there should be one code perhaps done by the PTA, another by church groups, another by any group that the parent values opinions. I think that what we want to have is a multiplicity of rating services, and a parent can choose which one to follow.
Have you met anybody in the television industry who supports the V-chip?
Very few. There are people in the cable business who support the V-chip, and there are people in the manufacturing business who support the V-chip. I think there probably are some silent people in the television business who support it, but many of them have done, in my opinion, an unpardonable thing by saying the V-chip is unconstitutional. And my answer to them is, if the V-chip is unconstitutional, so is a parent.
Why do you think that there are more advocates in cable than in broadcasting?
I think cable is less dependent on advertising than the broadcasters are. I think fundamentally the broadcasters are afraid that it will really hurt their advertising revenues.
Something else you recommend is that there be no commercials for programming geared to children under six.
Well, that's a view that Joan Cooney, who's an old friend who started Sesame Street, told me about, and she's absolutely right. Little children, small children, simply don't know the difference between a commercial and a program. They're incapable of knowing that difference. And I believe that where small children are concerned, let's say children under 4 years old, 5 years old, there should not be commercials which are designed to get them to get their parents to buy something.
Also, you write this about children's programming. You say that there should be a commitment to meet a specified standard of programming service for children on each channel, or the channel should forego public service to children and pay for their use of the spectrum. I want you to elaborate on that.
When broadcasting began in this country in the 1920s, Congress tried to figure out what to do, and it established a law which basically was a social contract between a broadcaster and the public. Under the law, the broadcaster is given the exclusive monopoly use of public property, a channel, in exchange for a promise to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. An element, of course, of the public interest is service to children. What has happened in the last few years, particularly in the 80s, is that half of that equation remained, the exclusive use of a public facility, but the other half of the equation, the obligation to provide public service, has been neglected and basically deregulated. Finally, in 1990, Congress did pass a law which requires that part of the obligation be service to children, but very little has been done to this date to spell that out. So what we're saying is broadcasters should be given a choice. Either fulfill your public interest obligations, or if you don't want to do that, then pay for the channel, and the money will be used to provide service to children and to hook up the schools and libraries of the country. We think the bargain that was originally proposed in the 20s should be renewed in the 90s.
What do you think about some of the current congressional proposals to keep violent programs off the air while children might be watching?
Well, the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia within the last couple of weeks has decided that such provisions are constitutional and consistent with the First Amendment. I think it is important. In fact, as we speak, there are hearings going on today in the Senate on various proposals dealing with this issue. And I think it is perfectly appropriate that some limits be placed on broadcasters producing violent programming when the fundamental bulk of the audience are children.
But if there was a V-chip, would that alleviate your concerns about what's
going
on?
Well, that would help. That would help a lot. I think you really need both. We now have a country where there are two parents, both of them are working. We have many millions of homes of single parents. It's pretty tough to be a parent in this world and have one hand on the television set all the time.
What constitutes censorship to you if the government starts interfering with what programs can be broadcast at which times?
I don't think that this would amount to censorship at all. If anybody wants to, first of all, you're dealing with what the law calls indecent. That's a technical term, indecent programming. And indecent programming can be on at a time when the bulk of the audience is not children. I don't think that's censorship. Anybody wants to see indecent programming can see it later.
If there was legislation that kept violent programs off the air during the hours that children were watching, I mean, who do you think should decide what constitutes violence and what the hours are? I mean, I know children who are awake much later than I am.
Well, I think that's the real dilemma. Also, children don't only watch children's programs. Children watch adult programs, and children are watching television at all hours, so it is a very hard one. I think there are studies that indicate when the bulk of the audience are children, right after school. There are very clear studies, and I know this is a delicate problem, but I don't think we should just throw up our hands and say we can't do anything about it.
So what were your children's favorite programs when you were the FCC commissioner?
Well, my children, my wife was pretty strict. In fact, we were talking to the kids about this the other day. My children are grown now. We asked them what they remember about television. They were only allowed to watch an hour a day and 2 hours on Saturday and Sunday. And they
were strict.
Well, they turned out very well, I'll tell you that.
I have to say, though, I think I turned out okay, and I watched a lot more than that. do you know what I mean? I just often wonder about that. You know, I watched at least a couple hours a night.
I don't think you were watching some of the things that are on now. If you took a look, if you take a look now, for example, at some of the talk shows that are on late in the afternoon when the kids come home, How I Slept with My Girlfriend's Mother, and all kinds of sexual masochism and bestiality, I don't think you'd say that today that would be the sort of thing that would benefit you.
So what were your children's favorite shows?
I think they loved the Disney programs. They loved the This was before Sesame Street started. But they loved a lot of the children's programs, and there were many of them, Captain Kangaroo and others, all of which are gone.
Newton Minow is my guest, former FCC commissioner under JFK, former chairman of PBS, now chairman of the board of the Carnegie Corporation, and co-author of the new book, Abandoned in the Wasteland, Children, Television, and the First Amendment. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Newton Minow, co-author of the new book, Abandoned in the Wasteland, Children, Television, and the First Amendment. When you were the FCC commissioner in the early 60s, it was the tail end of the single sponsor era on television. For instance, the Texaco Star Theater era, where a show had one sponsor and that sponsor's name might even be included in the title of the show. And for many shows, that meant the sponsor called the shots. What did you think the end of that era would mean?
Well, sometimes that was good, sometimes that was bad. If you had something like the Hallmark programs or the Bell Telephone Hour or the Philco Drama Hour, it was a good idea to have the sponsor be proud of the kind of programming that it was producing. As the business changed and people began to buy eyeballs rather than programs and rating points rather than programs, people lost the identity and pride that they had in a particular program. On the other hand, as we always say, there were instances where a gas company, for example, which was sponsoring a program, would not allow any reference to the gas ovens in the concentration camps. So there are two sides of that. But in many ways, I would welcome back the public-spirited companies as sponsors of major programs.
Your generation didn't grow up with television. When did you get your first TV?
The first television set I got was when I was in law school in the late 40s, early 50s. The minute I saw it, I knew that it was the most important invention, other probably than the atomic bomb of our time. If President Kennedy had asked me to be chairman of the SEC or the FTC or the ICC or the FPC, I would have said no. But I was so deeply interested in television, and the Kennedys knew that, that even though it was a tough time for me to go in the government, I knew this was a place where I had to have it take advantage of the opportunity to do something about it.
So you got your first TV when you were in law school. What did you watch?
I watched everything. At that time, the news on television, of course, was very sparse. It was 15 minutes of network news and watched the local news. Kukla, Fran, and Ollie, I was Bert Tilstrom's lawyer for many years.
He was the creator of the show.
He was the creator of the show and a marvelous man. I'm still a trustee for Burr. And there were many, many things in television that I loved. And I think... Today, the reason I get so frustrated is that I love television. I'm not one of those people who turn their nose down at television. I love television. I think it's extremely important. One of the things wrong in the country is that the academic community and the intellectual community have turned their nose away from television. They regard television as beneath their importance.
What are some of your favorite shows on television now?
I liked the Mary Tyler Moore Show so much that I watch all the reruns. I'm just delighted with it. I loved All in the Family, and I watch the reruns. I watch NYPD Blue. I watch CBS Sunday Morning. I watch all the news programs, the interview programs on Sunday morning that I can. I watch CNN very often to find out what's going on. And I'm a great radio listener as well. I should say I'm a total listener to NPR.
Well, you mentioned National Public Radio. I'm sure you've thought a lot about funding for public broadcasting, a big controversial issue right now. What kind of funding system would you like to see to support public radio and television?
I would like to see a system based on what we've done in the past when we created land-grant colleges. In 1862, Congress passed the Morrill Act. A Republican senator from Vermont or New Hampshire, I forgot which, proposed it. As we sold off public lands, a certain percentage of the money went to create land-grant colleges. Now we are about to sell another form of public property, communications channels. The FCC in the last year has conducted an auction of channels which were used for cellular telephone service and other communication service, has received about $10 billion. That money is going straight smack into the Treasury, where it will last about 39 hours. What I want to do is take a percentage of that, let's say 3% of those funds, and just as the Morrill Act created land-grant colleges, use that money for public radio, for public television, for connecting all the schools and libraries in the country with the information highway, and that's what I would hope would be done, and I hope Congress, again in a spirit of bipartisanship, would see this as an extraordinary opportunity to use that money in an intelligent way.
You always talk about how you think that broadcasters should be more aware of serving the public interest. And you cite the 1934 Communications Act, which gives broadcasters free and exclusive use of broadcast channels on the condition that they serve the public interest. But as you point out, the public interest was never exactly defined, so nobody knows precisely what serving the public interest is supposed to mean in this context. What problems do you think broadcasting has run into because of that?
Well, I think that it is not an easy problem, but I think one place where I think it's very easy, and that is that the public interest is the best interest of our children. There can't be any argument about that. We could argue about other things. When Congress created the Broadcasting Act, it took care of only one particular group of citizens, namely themselves, politicians. The only people that are currently protected by the Communications Act are candidates for public office who are guaranteed equal time, guaranteed the right to buy time at the cheapest possible rates. I want children to get the same attention that the Congress has given to themselves.
Newton Minow, he's co-author with Craig LeMay of the new book Abandoned in the Wasteland, Children, Television, and the First Amendment. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have from Bosnia?
We are looking at the alternatives as the United States and its allies are struggling with a response to Serbian takeovers in the safe areas, Terry. Also, President Clinton speaks out on religion, on prayer in school, and we think we're going to have something on base closings today. The Congress is contemplating cuts in education programs and block grants to the states, which some of the governors like better than others of the governors do. We have the election results from Haiti, and we'll be talking to Edwige Danticat about her country and her writing about the Haitian people.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On his new album, Mirror Ball, Neil Young has recorded with the Seattle grunge band Pearl Jam in what amounts to a summit meeting of two rock and roll generations. Made in just 4 days, Mirror Ball is at once typical of Neil Young's work and a departure. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You won't find Pearl Jam's name anywhere on Mirror Ball. Their record company won't allow the credit to appear on a rival record label. And listening to Mirror Ball, you wouldn't know it was Pearl Jam at all. Out of 11 songs, Pearl Jam vocalist Eddie Vedder sings on only two verses of one song, Peace and Love. The rest of the time, the band behaves like a younger, more energetic and compliant version of Young's prickly old backup band, Crazy Horse. The results are a first-rate Neil Young album through and through.
There's a place called downtown where the hippies all go, and they dance a Charleston, and they do the limbo. Yeah, the hippies all go there, 'cause they wanna be seen. It's like a room full of pictures, it's like a psychedelic dream.
Unlike most rockers his age, he'll turn 50 in November, Neil Young works in an infinitely adaptable style that can take on the notions and concerns of any era. In this case, the raw forthrightness of Young's guitar blare and his plaintively earnest vocals jibe with Pearl Jam's ideas of rock and roll authenticity. Young's song Peace and Love harks back to the 60s, when he was attaining stardom and the guys in Pearl Jam were stars in their mother's eyes. But Young isn't making fun of the idealism and good vibes of the 60s in this song. He's regretting a loss of idealism, the thing Pearl Jam mourns in many of its own songs. If your idea of a good Neil Young album is Harvest or last year's Sleeps with Angels, his quieter, folkier stuff, Mirror Ball isn't for you. On Sleeps with Angels, Young wrote a much-discussed lamentation for the death of Nirvana's Kurt Cobain. Cobain had included a few lines from one of Young's songs in his suicide note. Sleeps with Angels was heartfelt, but ultimately ineffective. It's here, in the grandly vulgar, open-hearted music that he makes with Cobain's contemporaries on Mirror Ball, that Neil Young makes good on his sorrow and his sincerity.
Ken Tucker writes about television for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Neil Young's new album, Mirror Ball. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.